live here in this country, harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and fought and died to be. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. I read about some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in fight. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in a fought and died key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in a fought and died key. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. That's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people. And, of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, this is the ethno-state that was recorded this week. This is what one show I was actually not on because I was running meetings in Canada for Jan Lamprecht, a videographer from South Africa. And this is this week's Ethno-State with Bill Johnson and guests.
Not sure if I really disagree with this or not. In fact, I think I kind of agree with it. This story came out of collegefix.com. The National Association of Scholars released a study documenting the voluntary racial segregation of students of color on 200 college campuses all over the country. And the conclusion is that there is an encouragement of segregation by racial ethnic groups, and I'm okay with that. My beef is they're encouraging all the students to do it except for white students, and white students are not supposed to have their own groups. We're talking with Rachel Pendergraf. How you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm glad to be here, and sorry we don't have some of our other usual guests, but I'm all excited and ready to talk.
I think Bill Johnson had some business, and Paul Fromm had some activism, and you know where your dad is. I don't know. Right. He's helping your mom, which I can't believe he'd pick his wife over us. But you know, things happen.
Good daddy and a good husband.
He's a good guy. For some reason, I don't know why, maybe it's the age, but he kind of reminds me of Paul Fromm. You know, I used to get him confused. One guy would say one thing.
And it may be because of a northern accent, perhaps, because my dad is originally from Detroit. And his family, before moving from Detroit, was from Toronto. So he where Paul is from. And so he, you know, my dad growing up spent a lot of time in Toronto and Canada around family members there and aunts and uncles and things like that. So maybe, I don't know, I'm just throwing that out as a possibility.
Possibility. I was kind of teasing Paul the other day because he's from Canada.
Uh-huh.
And I told him, you know, Canadians used to say A all the time, you know.
Right.
You know, I said nowadays they're saying Alakabar instead of A. And, well, I think you cracked a smile. Bad, so.
Yes. So I dated Canadian activist back in my teenage years, and that's what I always remember was the A or I, or I can't say it because I'm a Southerner, but now they've got so many Muslims moving into Canada, and they're just being beleaguered. Like the rest of us, and it's horrible what they are having to put up with up there.
They're flat taking over the country. Anyhow, back to our story. Just kind of wondering what you think about this. Here's my take on this is, it appears that what the cultural Marxists are doing is they are trying to put us in a position where people, using their term, people of color, the various ethnic groups have their own sense of identity, and they want to encourage that. And by the way, I'm all for it. I think it doesn't matter what your ethnic group, black, Hispanic, East Asian, whatever country you're from, you should have a strong sense of identity. Know who you are.
Right.
But the beef that I have, you know, freedom of association, hang out with people just like you, not just race.
Right.
But people like to hang out with, I don't know, religion or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm okay with that. But I think white people, what is it, Rachel?
Right. Well, I agree with you 100%. And I think that it's healthy. I think it helps promote a good self-identity, a self-esteem, and so forth, to be able to, like you say, freely associate with other people. I mean, you can look around and there's guilds for different craftsmen, and there's women's clubs and men's clubs, and unfortunately some of the men's golf clubs have got kind of hammered over the years, but I have no issue with men having their own golf clubs, women having female gyms, and young people having places hanging out, and older people, you know, doing whatever it is that they're doing and hanging out together. And that should, you know, be able to transfer over into race and ethnicity. And it's just, I think it's a fact of life that people feel more comfortable around people who they have similar interests and a commonality with. And unfortunately, what a lot of people would then jump on that statement I just made and say, well, you just pinpointed it there, that they would feel more comfortable. So what we need to do is force this idea, or force people to feel comfortable around other people. And that's what they did trying to, desegregate the schools and so forth. I remember here a few years ago on the anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education that Michelle Obama lamented that America's schools were more segregated than they ever had been before. And that's because white people and people of other races naturally and generally want to be in neighborhoods with people who are similar to them. And I don't see anything wrong with that. I would say that I do not support government-enforced segregation, but voluntary segregation or separation, whether that be by business or by church or by individual or by school, I think that's healthy for society.
It's good. It's good for us. You know, I like to hang out with my black friends. I like to hang out with my Asian friends. Got no problem whatsoever. I'm perfectly comfortable with them. You know, we have an affinity. It's more political than it is race. Yeah, we get along fine. But I don't like having it forced on me. The analogy that I like to use, Rachel, is, I don't know about you, but I like pizza. You know, I could swim. But,
he doesn't. So.
Yeah, but I don't want to be force-fed pizza. Mm-hmm. So liking it and having it forced on me, two different things. Uh-huh. And I think it's wrong to force something on somebody, even if it's right in most cases. There's some things you just don't force on people. But have you noticed, I don't know about you, but I don't watch a lot of television. But have you noticed they are force-feeding us integration on television? Not just in programming, but in commercials.
Yes, absolutely. And like you, I don't watch a lot of television, but I have a few of my favorite shows. And unfortunately, the commercials, because I don't subscribe to anything, I don't pay the extra money for, you know, commercial free. But I kind of figure it, well, you know, it helps keep me updated on what's going on in the world. And yeah, my husband and myself and my kids or grandkids, when they're over, even with my younger grandchildren, 5, 6, 7 years old, are able to pinpoint and spot what we call anti-white propaganda in the commercials, whether that's a white guy with an Asian girlfriend, or, you know, now they're really pushing the white guys and black women. They've been doing that with white women and black men. Now they're really, I'm really starting to see a lot of homosexual and lesbian couples being represented in the in commercials. And I've even noticed here in the last 6 to 8 weeks, I believe it's a CoverGirl makeup that has a transsexual young man putting makeup on, applying makeup, and the background or mantra to the whole commercial is, "You are beautiful the way you are," some nonsense like that, you know. So they show all these different, you know, races of women, and then they just stick this like dude in there too. He's applying his blush and eyeliner and stuff like that, and you know, they don't say anything about it. It's just supposed to be kind of subliminal.
Yeah, and subliminal.
They've been doing that with race for, you know, a good, you know, 40 years or so. Now they're really doing it with the transsexual, transgender, 54, whatever it is, you know. And yeah, it's really showing up on the commercials a lot.
They call that, using their term, they call that normalizing, getting us accustomed to it. But they want us to think in terms of, hey, we're a minority, lose your identity, be a part of multiculturalism. Now, we can see what they're doing. Oh, by the way, what is your favorite TV show?
I would have to say, if I got the name right, Burn Notice? No, that was like 10 years ago. I don't know, it's a girl that has a bunch of tattoos on her. I can't remember the name. They're trying to uncover the tattoos that are on this girl. It's like a FBI spy show.
I see. Okay, just curious. Got nothing to do with anything. But typically, the only TV that I watch is when I walk through the room and my wife's watching something, you know. But even then, I think it more jumps out at you because you're not used to it. You know, I'm old enough to remember, and I know your dad is too, back in the 50s, uh-huh. When you turn on your TV, everybody was white. I mean, almost everybody was white.
Right.
And I asked a black friend one time, he's about my age. Uh-huh. I said, what did you think about that? When you were little, when we were kids, and we'd watch TV, did that bother you? And he said, nah, that's just the way it was. Perfectly okay with it. And they say if there was a black person happened to be on the screen, they'd go and get everybody, you know, their family, and hey, look at the black guy. He made it on television, which, you know, but the reason I say that is because, geez, I better not say anything. He's a leftist nutcase. But I think I know how they felt, because now when I see white families on TV, they'll say, hey, look, it's a white family. When was the last time you saw that? Long time. But anyhow, back in the 1950s,
Well, like you said, we subscribe to different channels, so we can still watch, you know, Leave It to Beaver and Father Knows Best,
yep,
and Little House on the Prairie and a bunch of those different, we like to watch a lot of black and white shows and things like that also. And it is pretty striking to see, when they're walking down Springfield, Illinois on, Father Knows Best, you might every once in a while spot a black face in a crowd or something like that. And, I consciously notice that there's a black person in the crowd, just because it's, it was done in a generation when that wasn't as typical. But I think it's important for people to kind of look back and see the difference between programming then and programming now, like you say, because it is just vastly different.
Yeah, and one of the best ways to do that is on YouTube. There's a lot of all those old shows you mentioned. Yeah, you can watch them up. Do what?
We like watching Bonanza. We watch a. Of course, I always skip the ones where there's a bunch of anti-white, pro-Indian propaganda, because even all those old shows, they still, Dick Van Dyke Show, they still have their anti-gun few episodes and things like that. So that's really interesting, is to see the early stages of propaganda, even back in those earlier programs.
Yeah, it's always been there. You mentioned Bonanza. Who has Ben Cartwright? I forget his name. We're out of touch. Anyhow, whoever it was.
I couldn't tell you, other than last Saturday when I was watching, I actually focused on the actor's name. But I can't remember. I know James Arnaz from Gunsmoke, because he was, Matt Dillon was one of my favorite characters.
Yeah, but Ben Cartwright was Jewish.
Yes.
Whoever the guy was, I can't remember his name.
Right.
Little Joe was Jewish. They were all Jewish. You know, you're watching these white guys out in the Old West, and I'm thinking, they're not white guys. Well, maybe they are. It depends on your definition. But seriously, these Jews had ranches out. Maybe they did. I don't know. It was reality. But
they were usually found in the five and dime in the merchant class in town.
Yeah. But when I had my business, I had a little old Jewish lady worked for me. It was kind of backwards. You know, the white people are supposed to work for the Jews, but, she did a good job. She's blind as a bat, but, she'd have to look at stuff like this, but she did a good job. But the point that I was going to make is back in the 50s, and I'm old enough to remember this, the Mickey Mouse Club era, that the TV programming, they were traditional white families.
Right.
I think you mentioned a couple of them. Father Knows Best, Donna Reed Show.
Yeah.
Leave It to Beaver, I think you mentioned. I could probably think of a couple others. But they were traditional white families. Good entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
What was that other one? Where they had the maid? Hazel? You ever heard
Hazel,
of that?
Hazel, yes.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Yeah.
But 1960s came along, and they were still white families. But for some reason, they were no longer traditional. Now, there were exceptions, Little House on the Prairie. But somebody asked me one time, did you ever watch Mayberry RFD or Andy Griffith Show, whatever?
Uh-huh.
And he said, can you think of anybody on that show who was married? And I got thinking about it. Hey, what was the drunk's name? Otis?
Otis.
He was married. The rest of them weren't married. You know, there was no traditional family.
Right.
Now, there could be somebody I didn't think of, but then there was Family Affair. I don't know if you remember that or not.
I don't remember that one.
And the Beverly Hillbillies, that was not a traditional family. Good programming. I like it still. I like to watch them. But for some reason, it seemed like in the 60s, they transitioned.
Right.
Away from the traditional family. Now, I don't know if that is by design or if it just got better ratings. Made it more interesting. I don't know. But then the Norman Lear generation in the 70s, and then everything went berserk.
Right.
But the point of all of that goes back to our story, is they are forcing us being white people, to racially integrate. That is important. Because one of the key components to thought reform, one of the first things they have to do is strip away your sense of identity.
Right.
And I harp on this all the time. You need to know who you are ethnically. You need to know who you are racially. Mm-hmm. We need to know who we are religiously. We need to know who we are nationally. Or, you know, are we nationalist or are we globalist? Are we white or are we just, you know, there's only one race, the human race. That's what they like to say. The amalgamated American. But the point being, by stripping away our sense of identity, if we don't know who we are, then we're like putty in their hands. They can make us whatever we want. Now, I think you mentioned, Rachel, the guy who was in a beauty pageant. You know, that's another example. They're taking away our sense of gender identity. We don't even know what gender we are. I mean, you're born with an XY chromosome, you're a male, period. There's no argument about it. But by stripping away our senses of identity, they're able to get inside our heads and reform who we are or who we think we are.
Right.
The way that I like to say it is if you take away a compass, any direction could be north. So they take away our compass. You got any more thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I agree with you on just about every point that you made. I think specifically that the gender confusion that they're bringing to the lives of young people today, I think it's going to have a devastating, not just on our generation now and for those of us who are opposed to that, but I think it's going to have long-term psychological implications for masses of young people out there. Because, you know, young people, it is a difficult time in life for them, and they're trying to struggle with their identity and know how they fit into the world, and they want to go out and make it on their own. And then they throw this ratchet in there with, you know, these crazy mixed up, you know, psychologists they have on campuses, and the material that's thrown at them in sex ed classes, and you know, even just a regular English class now has to, you know, bring up the topics of proper gender pronouns and so forth. That's, you know, that can be a really confusing time for young people. And I think it's especially harmful. You know, you can say, well, that I don't see how that could really harm someone who's definite in their sexuality. Well, you know, this is a young girl, she knows she's a girl. This is a young boy, he knows he's a boy. But part of the Judeo assault upon Christianity and upon our gender identity and our race, you know, isn't just within the last few decades, but it's been going on for, you know, I think, you know, a good, you know, 100, 200 years, where they first, you know, you've got Sigmund Freud that come along, and then masters with their sex study of pedophiles and prostitutes in prison that's supposed to set the norm for sex for just average everyday men and women. But they put out this idea that boys who enjoyed poetry or music or the arts, or, you know, someone like a Shakespeare, people like that, if they just weren't into, you know, boxing it out and things like that, that, well, maybe they've got a secret feminine identity that they need to, you know, identify with. And the same with girls, you know, if she was a tomboy or something like that, then they started infecting people with these ideas that, well, maybe she's not a real girl because, you know, she's a little girl. She likes to go outside and climb trees with her brothers and things like that. So they really started, you know, this Judaic influence really started poisoning the minds of young people to where they thought that you had to act an exact certain way. And I am all for, you know, I mean, I've raised two daughters, I have a son, they have no identity confusion or anything like that. But my son likes to cook, my daughters like to climb trees. And I've seen some fathers actually berate their sons for wanting to take up music or learn an instrument or things like that. You know, you need to go out and tough it up with the boys. And those type of ideas what they do in the schools, these counselors, they will take ideas like that and then they will twist them and use that to inoculate in the minds of young children that perhaps you are gay, perhaps you are a lesbian, perhaps you do have some this gender dysphoria. And so then they have to come up with, you know, not just three or four identities, but 54 identities now, because they got these poor young kids so darn confused. And, you know, there's that old saying, does life imitate art or art imitate life? You know, I think there's a little bit of both there. These young people, to say that homosexuality and race mixing and interracial marriage, to say that it's not socially contagious, I think is a very, very dangerous concept, because I think it is socially contagious, just like people's views of beauty change from generation to generation. Maybe women were, in the Roman times, they liked them a little plumper. Now maybe they like them a little thinner. People's ideas of beauty change. Ideas are socially susceptible, and then they change. And I think that the era that we're in, I think young people are generally being brainwashed. They are being brainwashed and manipulated into not knowing what gender they are. And that's going to have a long-term consequence on this nation.
It's child abuse. A few years ago, they'd go to jail for that. By the way, I always encourage people, when they have time, just to do a Google search of the words teacher arrested and click on images. It is, it's appalling how many teachers are arrested for sexually abusing their students. The media talks about Catholic priests. They don't hold a candle to teachers. And we all know that there are a lot of good teachers. They don't all fall in that category. But the media lies by omission. They don't talk about it. Rachel, just kind of reflecting on something that you said, have you ever looked at a photograph of yourself when you were in high school?
I did yesterday.
And you say to yourself, what was I thinking? You know, because styles change.
Right. Absolutely. You know? Yep, I had the big hair.
You had the big hair?
Yes. In fact, talking about that, there's a, not that I want anyone to go out there and look at it, but there's an old video of me on the Ricky Lake show back in like maybe 94, 95. And I had my hair dyed darker then, and it was long and it was big and it was poofy. And you would be not be surprised how many emails and comments I've gotten over the years from people just that know me that's like, you know, ha ha, look at that hair. So yeah, but that was stylish at the time.
Yeah, well, 30 years from now, we'll be looking back and saying, geez, what right. were we thinking? That's assuming, man, I'll be nearly 100 years old 30 years from now. So I hope I'm looking back and thinking about that. But the point is, yeah, we go with the flow. We go with the movement of society. We just do it. That's why we speak English and not Chinese, because we're infected and
social creatures, right?
We're social creatures. And these people know that, and they use it to their advantage to exploit us and our kids.
Right.
Absolutely, positively amazing what they're doing. All right. There's something, here's a question for you to consider. Why? Why are they doing this? What do they hope to accomplish?
Yeah.
I mean, there's got to be a reason.
Yeah. Well, you know, my dad's a pastor, and I've spent a lot of time in church, and I teach Sunday school, and so I've just kind of got to go with what we believe. But we believe that it's a attack on white Western Christian civilization, and it's an attack on the order, the God's order in the world, and the two most paramount identification marks that God has set out in the world was race and gender. You're either male or female, or you're white or you're black, or you're some other race. But we were made distinct with our race, and we don't adhere to the Tower of Babel cause for differences in races, but that's nevertheless, that's another issue. If people want to say that's where it starts, fine, but we believe God has a divine order of races and of genders, and that the satanic rebellion is a rebellion, an attack against God. At the very root of God's order is cosmic order of race and gender.
Well, they say, Rachel, that white people used to be black or used to be dark. Remember the story, the news story about Cheddar Man? They did some DNA analysis and they said, hey, this guy used to be dark. What do you say to these people?
What do I think of them?
Well, how do you answer? Are they right? Are they wrong? If they're
No, I don't. You know, I believe that Adam and Eve were the progenitors of the white race, and I believe that other races were created separate and distinct. And I believe that oftentimes, if you have what appears to be parents of one race, and they have what they would call a throwback in a child, that you see a different racial aspects in the child, I think that just is evidence of genealogical, some people would call it contamination or input or mixing of genes somewhere in the background, but that would be my answer. Fortunately, you know, for the most part, even a paper put out here about 2 years ago, I believe it might have been the Scientific American, I may be wrong on that, but they had done a DNA and genetic study of white Americans throughout north, south, east, and west, really when this DNA kits and things like that were really growing in popularity. And they said that despite the often purported idea that white people in America are, you know, mixed somewhere, some way, way back somewhere, they said surprisingly that white people in America are white. For the most part, the majority, the highest percentage of all white people have no a mixture of any other blood in them. They're, you know, white European people.
Science has discovered that white people are white.
Yeah.
Brilliant. And how much did they spend on that study? Do you wonder? Taxpayer money, who knows?
Right.
When I heard that study, first of all, I doubt it. Because what I read was the DNA of Cheddar Man, which is what? This guy was around 9,000 years ago. They said that, if I understood the news story correctly, his DNA could have, or it had the components, the elements, that would have allowed him to be dark. But in no way was it conclusive that the guy was dark. But so what if he was? What that means is, as Europeans went from dark to light, they became more intelligent. They became more innovative. I don't think they thought of that. Because what they're saying is, hey, white people are smarter than dark people. They're more innovative. They're more creative. You know, but that thought didn't occur to them. All right. So any other thoughts?
Okay, I know, you know, there's a lot of, you know, different opinions, and whether you're a creationist, biological creation, or geological creation, or whether, you know, evolution or what. But, you know, when it all boils down to it, you know, white people have a right to preserve their history and their people, and we have a right to preserve what we are now and what we want to be in the future.
But we have a right to say it, but there's a lot of people who don't think we do.
Yeah.
They want to absolutely, positively shut us up. They don't like what we're talking about right now. I get messages on my YouTube channel all the time calling me a racist. I'm just telling the truth. Uh-huh. How is reality racist? This is a story from WashingtonExaminer.com. And the story is that there is a marked increase in the prison population by percentage of Hispanics. And the story is that, according to the Washington Examiner, that there is a 2% increase in Hispanics over a 10-year period, a 20% decrease in blacks, and almost a 13% decrease in white prisoners. So as the nation turns browner, so does the prison population.
Yeah, yeah.
According to Facts USA 2019 annual report, it says now that Hispanics are 18% of the population of the United States. That's up from 8% in 1990. Going back when I was a kid, I hate to keep saying that because when I was younger, when I was a kid, I hate it when people said when I was a kid, but when I was a kid, I don't remember seeing Mexicans. Ever, anywhere. You know, I went to a black majority high school, barely, 51% black. And we were black and white. There was one girl who was Chinese, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
That was the makeup, racial makeup of pretty much her. City. Things are changing. 1950, just before I was born, 90% of people in America were white. Mm-hmm. New York City, if you go back 100 years, was like 97% white. There was virtually no crime in New York City. Imagine that. Detroit, Michigan, virtually no crime. There were some, very little. Chicago, Illinois, virtually crime-free. It was like a country town. You go out and walk the streets at night, no problem. Just watch out for the horse. You know, careful what you step in. But that was right. That was it. And with few exceptions, crime was like a country town. But something has happened with the demographic shift. We cannot talk about it because if we do, they call us racist. So we just ignore the fact that 52.2% of all homicides in America are committed by blacks, who comprise about 13% of the population. And nearly all those crimes are committed by black males, who make up, what, 6.5% of the population?
It's like Ann Coulter said a few years ago, we don't have a gun problem, we have a demographic problem.
Well, you can't say Negro problem, because you get in trouble. But That's a matter of fact. And it's not just our problem. They're killing each other.
Right.
So Black Lives Matter, you know, you've got to admit that reality. Why is it, Rachel, that we can't talk about this stuff? No, obviously we can because we are. But when people hear me talking about this, they say, oh, you're a racist. I'm not. You know, I don't dislike anybody for any natural characteristic. I just don't. But reality is reality. I think it's immoral to dislike people because of natural characteristics. But I also think it's immoral to deny reality.
Right.
So why can't we talk about this?
Right. Absolutely. Well, again, you know, I think it's an attack upon Western Christian civilization. And it's something that's worldwide. You know, in Ethiopia, the black people there are having problems with the Chinese immigration and exploitation of Ethiopians by the Chinese and so forth. They likewise are being suggested that they don't really talk about those issues there. So it's the issue of race worldwide and globally that the cultural Marxists do not want anyone to talk about, because they want us to kind of live in this fuzzy world where we just all kind of co-mingle together and I guess lose our racial distinctions. You know, they try to separate people from class. That didn't work. So now, instead of viewing people separated as race, even though they talk about white people being oppressors, they talk about Black Lives Matter, the whole point of it all is through white guilt on the white people's part and through hatred, vented up hatred and malice on the part of other races who get kind of get a chip on their shoulder at all the oppression and exploitation that white people supposedly have done, that somehow we'll meet in the middle and become an amalgamated group and race of worker drones, so a few fat cats at the top can run their Amazon empire. That's the way I kind of view it. And I think a lot of it, you know, it has to do with destroying our morals and our Christian heritage and civilization. But I told you I had a sore throat earlier, starting to catch up with me now. But I think that the saying, you know, follow the money, I think if you follow the money and go back, I think it's always about a profit motive. And, you know, as a Christian, you know, I mentioned the Tower of Babel before. As a Christian, a lot of people are familiar with the terminology of the Babylonian system and the financial empires and so forth that really hold and harness the nations and governments and people. And I think there's a very evil, elite-minded people out there who want to destroy our heritage so they can live high on the hog.
They're doing it.
They are,
you know,
doing it.
It's not just, the way that I view this, Rachel, is I see cultural Marxism as a cult. But it's very successful. They never identify themselves. They're very covert. But they never say we're Marxist. I mean, maybe in Cuba they do, or Venezuela, but here they don't do it. But still, they're Marxist. And it is, I treat it like a dangerous religion.
Mm-hmm.
And they use the same thought reform techniques as did James Jonestown, and these other dangerous religious cults. They get inside our heads. And they're winning. You know, separation of church and state. What about separation of cultural Marxism? Right. Ideology at our government schools. You know, you can't go into government school.
Because you're right, it is a religion.
It is.
It's their religion.
But you can't go into a government school and talk about religion. But if your religion happens to be Marxism, well, it's mandated. Not only can you do it, but you should do it. I was looking up an article a few seconds ago when you were talking, because you mentioned the Chinese in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
This was written by Francis Galton, mid-1800s, who was a cousin of Charles Darwin.
Okay.
And he said, this is a letter to the editor of the Times, which I'm assuming is New York Times, even though he was British. But it says, my proposal is to make the encouragement of the Chinese settlements at one of the more suitable places on the east coast of Africa a part of our national policy, in the belief that Chinese immigrants would not only maintain their position, but that they would multiply and their descendants supplant the inferior Negro race. I mean, this is an editorial in the Times. Back then, they thought nothing of saying this.
Yeah.
In their minds, they were just being realist.
Mm-hmm.
Then he goes on and he writes this. He said, I should expect a large part of the African seaboard, now sparsely occupied by lazy, I don't even know how to pronounce this word. Palavering, I'm going to have to look that up, savages. Anyhow, he calls them lazy savages. Living under the nominal sovereignty of Zanzibar or Portugal, might in a few years be tenanted by industrious, order-loving Chinese, living either in a semi-detached dependency on China or else in perfect freedom under their own law either way. So his whole article, kind of lengthy, is about this. But this was one of the brightest minds of his day. one of the most respected scientists of his era. And he was saying Africans are lazy. The best thing to do is colonize Africa with Chinese and let them do something with that continent. Seems like he's getting his wish. What do you think?
It seems like he is getting his wish. Well, you know, I kind of like the idea of everyone, and this is kind of a talking point that we use, and I think it's something that most people kind of agree with, and it's something very simple that I use with my own grandchildren, and I think simple idea just for the masses out there, is that everyone's entitled to have their own place, you know? We're entitled to our own land, to a share of the earth, to do with what we will. And so, you know, I think the Chinese should probably stay in, you know, they've got the Orient, and let the Africans, you know, have parts of Africa that they're, you know, native to. I don't suggest that they multitude and then migrate into South Africa or places where white people have, you know, built up industry and then take advantage and attempt to take that over. But if, you know, if it wasn't for all the Western aid programs into Africa, they would still just be a small population anyway. And it'd be something you'd see a few tribes here and there when you went on safari or something like that. So, you know, I certainly don't want to see the Chinese just continue to multiply and proliferate over the face of the earth, which I think they have a real possibility of doing. But I would say let everyone have their own place, kind of the castle doctrine. Everybody kind of needs their own castle.
Yeah, this land is our land. This land is your land. That's Marxism. This land is our land. That land over there is your land. So who was it? Arlo Guthrie that wrote that song? The guy was a communist. He was advocating communal, you know, abolition of private property.
Right.
This land belongs to you and me. That's what he wrote. No, it doesn't. This land is my land. That land is your land. I mow my grass. You mow your
grass. This is my border. This is my border wall.
Yeah, this is my border wall. All right, back to the story. It says the average American looks today looks and lives differently than they did 30 years ago. Today, 61% of the population is non-Hispanic white, down from 76% in 1990. The other day, a few weeks ago, I was watching a video by Kenny Loggins. Footloose, remember that?
Yeah. I never actually watched it, but...
Yeah, that is a good singer. But as I was watching that video, it occurred to me that everybody in the video, they were all white people. I think that was the 1980s, and nobody thought a thing of it. So that recently, it was perfectly acceptable. You know, if you're a white singer, you got white backup kids, you know, who are dancing in the background, whatever. So 30 years ago, 61%. Was 76% rather was white. Meanwhile, the story says, this is according to Facts USA, I think it's factsusa.com, the Hispanic and Asian populations have doubled as a percentage of the total over that time. So they are literally taking over our country, the country that you mentioned this a second ago. This is a society, a culture that we built, the infrastructure. Uh-huh. You know, again, 100 years ago, New York City, 90%, 97%, I think it was, white. 90-something percent. I don't know. All these big cities used to be white. White people built this country. And I like to tell people this, and I'm sure you have too, Rachel, just look around you. Point to something that was not invented by white people. Can't do it. It's impossible. And if you find something that maybe was invented by a non-white person, I like to use the USB port. That was an Indian that invented that. But if you find something that was not invented by a white person, they built on Western innovation, white people's innovation, or it wouldn't be here. So we're talking about Africa a second ago. Mm-hmm. How many Africans today would be alive if it were not for Western technology in the medical field?
Right.
Medical technology. The Ebola virus, white people went in, basically solved the problem.
Right.
What if they hadn't? What if they just let them die? What would have happened with that Ebola virus had it not been for Western technology saving their lives?
Right.
I like to tell the story about going to an emergency room in Vero Beach, Florida. I don't know if you heard me say this or not, but I said it a million times. But I went into the emergency room, and Vero Beach is basically a white community. But everybody in the emergency room at 2 in the morning, and there was a lot of them, like a couple hundred, I would guess. I didn't see one white person, the security guard, the nurses were white, everybody else was dark. They were taking advantage of our technology, and not one of them came up and said thank you. I don't know why. Some of them stared at me like, what are you doing here, white boy? But, you know, that's, for some reason, they are missing that. Right. So the point is, Western culture in the United States is being depleted, and it seems to me it's by design. Same thing in Western Europe, same thing, well, all of Europe, same thing in Australia. It's already been done in South Africa. We are losing our culture. So it's just too coincidental.
Uh-huh.
And Bill Johnson and I kind of argue this back and forth. But it just seems to be causal rather than coincidental that somebody is making this happen. Now, I just don't believe in conspiracy theories. But still, there has to be somebody that's saying, hey, let's change the immigration laws of all Western nations at the same time, mid-1960s. They all changed, and nobody was paying attention. I was like 65, I was what? 12 years old, last thing on my mind was what was happening in Washington. It was like, Rachel, it was like the cultural Marxist detonated a nuclear bomb on the United States in 1965 when they passed the Immigration Act. But nobody noticed because it was an invisible bomb. But today, we're still feeling the blowback from that. They're destroying our culture. Okay, now what do we do about it?
Well, you know, I think part of what we need to do is to recognize that there is a problem. And you mentioned about conspiracy theories. You know, I like to remind people about the Frankfurt School and the social engineers that were kicked out of Germany. And so then they set up a shop at Columbia here in the United States and have proliferated throughout the university system in this country. Have educated a mass of teachers and educators that has trickled down into society and has changed everything from our English to our ideas of censorship and free speech to sex and marriage and child rearing to laws to immigration. All of it has changed, and the white man and woman, or the white, you know, more focused, the white family is going to bear the brunt of all of this, and it's the white family that is going to be eradicated. And so I think the answer is that the white family, you know, I think, you know, and as I said before, I am a Christian. I think the institution of marriage was put together, created by God as the cornerstone of civilizations, many Christians likewise believe. And for our white civilization to make a rebound and to ward off disease and to become healthy, to immunize ourselves against any future reproach upon our people and our faith and civilization, I think that it takes, again, an emphasis on strong families. And so I believe as if you want to talk about white nationalists or patriots or conservatives or whatever, nativists, whatever type of name you want to call all these all of our mixed, you know, ideas and people out there and movements and so forth. I think that we need to put a strong focus back upon the family. And a lot of them do that, but they do it by talking about the family rather than actually including the family. So I think the family and young people and kids, they need to grow up in this knowing that they have a right to fight for, like we're talking about old times, you know, back in the 80s when I grew up, there's a song called "We Have the Right to Fight to Party," okay? I think young people today, they need to know that they've got a right to fight for their race and for their family and for their future. And you don't just do that by having meetings around the country and then just talking at people. You do it so we do it by creating a culture of family in this country and being more inclusive of families, in conferences, including women and children, making this a fight for the family. And I'm not suggesting putting women on the front lines, but remember ancient Sparta, the women and children and the men all knew what their duty in life was, and that was to protect their society. And it was because it was all a part of what, from infancy, it was a part of what and who they were. And I think we need to generate that in among our people so that it's a family affair. Not just talking to the family, but making the family a part of the fight for our people. And so that's where I think it begins.
Have you noticed the cultural Marxists, the globalists, the leftists, they love to ridicule and demean the 1950s culture? Kind of throwback to what we were talking about. They absolutely hate it. Because that was a point in time when that was kind of the end of it. But that was when the family was still respected.
Right.
And it was the core of the infrastructure.
Right.
These fake feminists, and I don't call them feminists because they're not, but these fake feminists, they ridicule the 1950s housewife.
Oh, sure. Remember Hillary Clinton's famous remark about, "No, I'm not a woman like that." I was saying,